Welcome to ITE 1, Module 5, Part 3. We're going to, hopefully, I don't see why we wouldn't finish up this module. That's what we're going to do today. This is operating systems, a lot of how to configure and customize your operating system, as well as the boot process, which we need to learn, as well as the boot process, which for A-plus people is something that you'll really want to know. No problem. We're gonna do some work on that today. Starting next week, I'm just going to warn you all now that we will have some participation assignments, which means that if you are here, you'll have one less lab to do because some of the labs starting in Module 6 we get to do in class. Just quick stuff, basically, but you will, not in every chapter, but in most chapters from 6 on, you will have some kind of a participation exercise where you won't have to do a lab if you show up, basically, because we'll be doing it in class. So just fair warning that that is going to start happening. I'll also email about that. It's a good thing to be here and not have to do that, one of your labs. Okay. What else? Does anyone have any questions, comments, concerns on labs?
I almost missed a lab today thanks to Gmail's spam filter. It's a good thing I went looking for something else.
Awesome.
Usually it's better than that.
Yeah.
You will always get false negatives on a spam filter that filters on content, which is why none of my spam filters ever do, because there is always the risk of a false positive, no matter which one you use.
Do you
I do
spam
check it. It's
filters
interesting to see what they think of me. The spammers, I mean.
We actually have we use RBL, which is a registered block list, and we actually have a whole lot of sites in China and stuff that cannot even connect to our mail server. So yes, we do get 5 or 6 spam messages a day, but we don't get false positives. That is down from the 40 or 50 that we would get if I turned the filters off.
Yeah. And Thunderbird has a really good junk filter that will you can train and everything. So my student labs, I usually at the beginning of the year mark your address as not junk, and I don't have that problem.
Yeah, a lot of people don't
Gmail's
realize
been
if you
the only
train a
spam filter.
Bayesian filter, if you're training a Bayesian filter, it's very important that you train it what's not junk as well as what is junk. Most people just go junk, 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 but they don't tell it what it should see as well. And it's important to mark the stuff that's important to you as not junk, because it makes the training about 60% faster.
Do you mark everything that shows up in the junk folder as not junk, or just everything, period?
No, you mark the things that you want to read as not junk. So when you're training it, you mark the stuff that's junk as junk, and you mark the stuff that is not junk as not junk. And this is not part of the lecture, so we'll come back to this at a later point.
Okay, any other questions on labs? One other very important question. Does anyone have anything they want to work on for study group tomorrow? Because if not, the repo presentation will be at 9 o'clock during our study group time. So if anyone wants any study group meeting, let me know.
Reaper, Reaper, Reaper.
Does anyone need any, anyone want any kind of study group this week, or are we good on our labs?
If you do
Yeah.
email
Or
us.
you can say if you want people to talk about, if you have something you want people to talk about and you feel comfortable saying so, now's the time so that we know and can tell Simon that he'll start an hour later.
And don't feel saying so is going to make you unpopular. We don't care. We want to help you.
No. People who, yeah. We want you to get the help you need. So if you have something you want to have a group work on, then tell us.
Also, keep in mind that we are on Skype and that calling us is not a sin. Okay? So, you can
No.
actually Skype us up and ask us questions, and we will do our best to answer them. Obviously, Grace and Shawnee are primary instructors, but if they're not around, I can probably field most ITE1 questions being in the industry for 15 years. And I'm sure that, we're more than happy to help you. So don't just sit in front of those labs getting sadder and sadder, ripping the block of chocolate out of the refrigerator and hoeing down on 3 rows of it because you can't figure out the answer to something. The solution is Skype an instructor, with a disclaimer that if you don't eat chocolate, the above might not apply to you.
And sometimes if you get the right instructor at the right time, you can call to ask about one lab and end up with a 4-hour fun-filled conversation.
Aiden has done this.
I actually have had quite a few calls from students this week, and it's been a lot of fun. And I told the person who called me, I said, "Thanks for calling me. I look forward to having students call me," which maybe I
That's
just
hard
don't have
if
that
I can
happen
help them.
enough.
If I can help, I will. Two other quick things I want to talk to you guys about today. The accessible lab tips document. If you're not sure how to do a lab, it's in your zip file and it's also in the labs folder for ITE1. If you're not sure how to do a lab, you may want to look at that because it may have some ideas for you on how to do the lab. And if you're saying that this doesn't make sense or this isn't accessible or I don't have these materials, well, we probably thought of that and we probably put it in the accessibility tips document, which took us quite a bit of time to formulate and write up. And no other classes actually had this document to help them figure out what to do in these situations. This was something that I came up with last year. So before
Yeah, you're lucky.
panicking, check that document because it has lots of tips on how to do labs if you don't have materials or if you get stuck.
There are also four copies of it. One copy in each of the two zip files, one in the root of the labs folder, and one in the non-graphical and graphical subfolders. So if you cannot find it, you have a problem. It's called accessible lab something, and it's a
Yeah, I think
dot
it's
file.
accessible lab tips.
Yeah, I found that out this module. I looked there first.
Yeah, it has a lot of stuff in Module 5. Tons and tons and tons of stuff. And it's a really good one. So,
She's not just saying that because she wrote it.
no, I'm saying it because it took me like a whole night to write up and I'd really love you guys to use it because it's cool. So don't be offended if you ask me a question and I say, have you checked that document? If so, check it. And if you're still really stuck and don't understand what it says, let me know and I'll be happy to help you.
She doesn't usually talk like that, by the way.
The
I was
other
going
thing
to
I
say
want to
something,
tell.
but
What?
Never mind.
What did I do?
Why are you sort
You
of put
just
on
kind of
this
sounded
voice
all
like
preppy,
this?
and
Oh, okay.
it
Oh,
was
be
funny.
nice.
Okay, so the other thing I want to tell you guys about is the virtual machines. If you don't have a virtual machine and you are kind of scared to do any of these labs, you're afraid you're going to break something, and you have a computer that is fairly modern, has a couple gigs of RAM, even a gig of RAM will probably do it. You can have a virtual machine, which is like a computer inside of a computer, and you can break it, and you can do horrific things to it, and it doesn't matter because you can just unzip it again, and it'll be exactly the way it was. It comes with NVDA on it and no virus software, so you'll have to get virus software because this is a real computer inside of your computer. If you are interested in having a virtual machine, there's an area called Virtual Machines, Restricted Access. If you want the username and password to that area, please email Kavi Instructors and we will provide it to you. Once you get into this area, there is a copy of VMware Player. There is a copy of a few virtual machines. The XP Service Pack 3 one is probably the one you want. And there's documentation on how to use it. You download them. You install VMware Player, you extract the virtual machine, and you can use it. And they're very cool. Again,
And you
you want to
must
read the
use 7-Zip
documentation?
to extract them.
Yes. You must use
So
7-Zip.
that's also
Found.
available under extras.
Yep. Again.
Why did we use 7-Zip? You're all going to ask me because Mac users hate 7-Zip. One of the reasons is that WinZip is not compatible across platforms and uses its own bizarre compression methods. And WinRAR is not free despite the number of people who just went out and cracked the latest version yesterday. Yeah, I know you
There
all know
is
it
a
is awesome.
program for the Mac called called the Unarchiver, and I believe it will do 7-zip, and just about, it's even better than Stuffit Expander, and I will look right now and make sure 7-zip is in there and let you know in a minute here.
I don't we will
think
completely...
it does the numbered archives, but I believe it does do just standard 7-zip. I think I checked
You
that.
Will need something that does the numbered archives, because you're of three parts of it. We will completely help you, as long as you have read the documentation. If you've read our documentation that has come with it, and it's very easy to understand documentation, very nicely laid out and everything, we will help you. If you ask us a question that is obviously in the documentation, we will tell you to read it. Just because that documentation took us a while to write up, and it's very nice.
Also, there is a command line 7-zip extractor for the Mac, and you can just go 7z space x space blah dot 1, and it will extract the entire multi-volume archive. So, that's another way of doing it. Sorry, it doesn't GUI itself, but it will work.
Any questions on the virtual machines or the accessibility tips document? Alrighty then. Let's get going. All right. So, did I talk to you guys about ASR and how to do ASR last week?
Nope, I don't think so.
Okay, well that's where we'll start. Because I talked about safe mode and a little bit about why you'd use a recovery. Okay, a little bit about when a recovery disk would be particularly useful. Yeah, I did. Okay, you must create an automated system recovery, ASR, through Windows Backup. To restore from your ASR, press F2 when booting the Windows installation disk. ASR reads the set and restores the disks that are needed to start the computer. After the basic disk information has been restored, ASR installs a basic version of Windows and begins restoring the backup created by the ASR wizard. In Windows 7, you can use a system recovery disk to boot the computer and then use system recovery tools to recover Windows 7 from errors that prevent system startup. You can also use a system recovery disk to boot the computer and restore the entire computer from a system image.
Inaccessible. However, you can do it.
You can do it if you've got eyes.
May we plug Terabyte Software, which is image for Windows, DOS, and Linux, which Brian loves and has a copy of, and it will do all of your restoring for you automatically if it's onto the same drive geometry off your bootable media that it makes, which we've discussed in our backup chat. Please refer to that for accessible information.
And good morning, Maria. Okay, to create a Windows 7 system recovery disk, click Start, Control Panel, System and Security, Backup and Restore, Create a System Repair, Restore, Create a System Repair Disk. Gee, that's a mouthful. Insert a blank disk in the optical disk drive and click Create Disk. Test the disk by using it to boot the computer. After the System Recovery Options screen is displayed, highlight the operating system that needs to be restored and click Next. The following tools should be available.
We'd need a DVD, wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah. Startup, Repair, System Restore, System Image Recovery, Windows Memory Diagnostic, Command Prompt, Factory Recovery Partition.
Whoa, that's
that
cool
wasn't
stuff.
Actually That wasn't... Factory Recovery Partition was supposed to be another heading, but wasn't. So that isn't an option. Sorry about that. Okay. Some computers that came with an operating system pre-installed have a partition that is inaccessible to the user. Not inaccessible to us, inaccessible to everyone. You can't see it, usually. This is called the factory recovery partition. This restores your computer to the way
you
first
got
it.
I've seen them.
Yeah, sometimes you do in the older ones, but on the newer ones, you're not going to see it as much. Yeah,
Just be warned here, guys, if you buy an OEM copy of the operating system, which you usually do on a new machine, and you don't make the disks, and you don't make the CDs, and your factory recovery petition gets corrupted, they will charge you for replacement media.
Yes, I was going to say that, but now I don't have to. This restores your computer to the way you first got it from the manufacturer. Occasionally, the option to reach this partition is hidden, and a special combination or key is used when booting the computer. The option to restore from the factory recovery partition can also be found in the BIOS of some computers. Contact the manufacturer to find out how you can access the partition and restore the original configuration of the computer. Okay, so there are a couple things to remember about manufacturer recovery partitions.
Or try Google.
Yeah. They restore your computer exactly to the way it was when you first got it. This means all your data is gone and all of the junk that came pre-installed on your computer is back. So, you've got to go and get rid of it all and install all of your programs. Also, as I said, as Carrie said, you... Yeah, AOL, Norton Free Trial, all their stupid wild tangent games, all the crap that just sits on your computer and is absolutely useless to us blind people or anyone. But I didn't say that. You gotta go get rid of it all again. Clean up your computer. As Carrie said, you may get the option to create these recovery disks when you first boot up your computer. You should do this because some of these people, Dell, will charge a pretty penny for disks if you are, if your partition is corrupted. And you know what? If you have those disks with you right now, you don't have to wait the week for them to send you the disks.
The other thing is that if you forget to take the key off the bottom of your computer or the sticker on your computer and write it down, which should be about the third thing you do when you get your new computer, the only way to install the pre-activated version of Windows is from that recovery media. You won't have a valid OEM key to install another OEM installation of the operating system. So make sure you either use one of the key finder programs like BellArc Advisor or Magical Jelly Bean Key Finder to get your key out, or you get somebody sighted to read it off the sticker on the computer and you put it down either with a digital voice recorder or type it into a document and store it in a safe place, TM, i.e. your Dropbox, perhaps. If you don't have Dropbox, please talk to one of your CAVI instructors so that we can get referral credit. Thank you.
And you all should totally have it. It's so good.
Oh my lab, I can't we're in Dropbox.
I can't see a way to make it a requirement. Yeah, I can't see a way to make it a requirement of the course, but it totally should be, because it's free, and it's, like, seriously one of the most useful programs on my computer. It is important to understand what happens when a computer boots. This can help you troubleshoot computer problems. It is incredibly testable, you guys. I don't think it's on your Module 5 test anymore, but if you're doing A+, you want to know this in and out. And honestly, you just want to know this because it is good to know and it really does help troubleshoot.
That said, if you ask the average instructor how this works and they're not looking at their notes, they won't be able to tell you. Just putting that in.
Yeah. No, I think I might actually have it after the third or fourth one time
I've
taught it.
There was a neat XP video out there in CAVI Discuss Land last term.
Try the list archives.
That was out there. Yeah, I was just going to say about the Windows XP boot sequence, and it was pretty good.
Yeah, it was very narrated and described and everything. It was
Wow.
Okay. The first step of the boot process. Okay, this is an easy one. Can anyone tell me what you think the first step of the boot process is going to be?
The post?
No, even before that. We've got to turn it on. This is called a cold boot. That's okay.
It's the first step. Nothing happens before you turn it on.
Yeah, it can't post until you press that button.
The first step is thinking about turning it on, isn't it? I think that's what the first step is.
The
second step is then actually deciding you're going to turn it on. All right, how far do we want to go back?
But it's important to understand that we need to press the button or flip the switch or whatever. Most of the time it's going to be pressing the button. That's going to be a cold boot. Yeah.
Anybody know where everybody is?
Watching the final.
I was wondering.
Watching the final four game, probably.
Yeah, hang on. We don't have many people.
We're missing tons of people. I know where some people are.
I noticed that too.
And I'm betting you that a couple people are going to show up at 10 o'clock because they got confused. Yeah.
Seems like the people who always show up are here, though.
Yeah. I know that Dana's having hard drive trouble, so he'll be back.
Ouch.
Don't know.
Send good karma
Luke's
thoughts
on
his
vacation.
Way.
Yes. Luke's on vacation. I'm betting you he got confused about daylight savings, too, because he thought he was going to be able to be here. Because I talked to him yesterday. I'm guessing there's a basketball game on.
Yeah, because there's only 10 people in here.
Yeah, yeah. It's ridiculous.
The other thing I was going to point out is that the fixed time calculator has changed its name to the meeting planner, just in case you're looking for it, Sean. They've changed its name.
Oh, that's what I thought it should have been before. Okay, good to know.
Okay, so we got a cold boot. There's another button that you can press if you either restart your computer from Windows and tell it to restart, or you press that little reset button, which isn't the best idea to do, because it basically
no.
just cuts it off.
No. Reset button is not a warm boot.
No?
Absolutely not, because it actually cuts the power to the system board for a split second and brings it back. That is actually still a cold boot.
You can actually hear it sometimes. On my network, you can really tell it. Yeah.
Okay. So if you actually restart your computer using the correct way of doing it, you know, actually restart my computer, that is a warm boot. So that is why, you know, and this boot process will start all over again. So either turning it on or giving it a warm boot, restarting it, is going to initiate this boot process. Okay, next the computer performs a power on self-test or POST. This checks the main hardware components of the computer are working properly. Now, the things it's going to check in POST, and this is important and will be important for troubleshooting labs, it's going to check your motherboard, make sure that all of that's okay, your RAM. It's going to check your video card. That's basically about it. It's not going to check your hard drives. It's not going to make sure there's bootable media on your hard drives. It's going to check your basic hardware. So if we have a problem where there is it fails during POST, it isn't that the operating system is corrupted. Just remember that.
This is strictly through POST, correct? All these things.
Yeah. If you have a failure at POST, it probably has nothing to do with your hard drive or the operating system. It's going to be something very basic, and it's hardware.
And you'll get BPs.
It's a very foundational test. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's hardware.
Look up POST on Wikipedia. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, it actually talks about what it tests. It tests the RAM, the CPU, the DMA controllers, the ALUs, the CPU logic, the wraparound stuff, the keyboard
and
controller.
Other things that have POST that we didn't think of, like
SCSI BIOSes and all that sort of stuff.
Yep. Any of your cards? If you've taken a part of computer and you fail POST, the first thing you want to check is that all of your cards and all of your RAM is reseated correctly, because that can make it fail POST. It's not your hard drive. It's going to be something more fundamental than that. Okay, after POST, the BIOS reads the configuration file located in CMOS. The boot device priority tells your computer in what order to check devices for something to boot. This can be set in the BIOS. If a device has no bootable media, the computer passes it by and moves on to the next device. Okay, so if the boot order were floppy drive, optical drive, hard drive, and there was no media in the floppy, an MP3 mix you made last week in the optical drive, and Windows OS on the hard drive, what would happen?
Yeah, it would just pass on to the C drive, wouldn't it?
Yep, mm-hmm. It should. Absolutely.
Unless it gets hung up on the whatever's in the other drive.
Yeah, it may try to spin up on the CD drive for a second, but it should pass it by unless there's something very wrong. and you're going to get to the C drive. You can also have network or flash drives or SD cards in your boot order on some of the newer BIOSes. Many computers have a key or key combination that you can press during post to manually select which device you want to boot for that particular computing session. Lots of netbooks will let you do this, actually. It's mainly on netbooks and laptop devices.
Modern desktops. All the modern desktop Asus boards have F8 for the boot menu. It's actually, I don't know what standard it came in, but anything that's made in the last year should have the ability to pull this menu up.
Okay. This is good for things like Vinix Live CDs. Once the boot device is found, the BIOS locates its master boot record, or MBR. The MBR locates the operating system's bootloader, which in XP, and I think basically every other version of Windows past XP, is called NT Loader or NTLDR. At this point, NTLDR takes over the boot process. If there is more than one operating system present on the media, it runs boot.ini, which prompts you to choose the operating system you would like to launch. To change the operating system from the default, press down arrow. Otherwise, boot.ini will eventually time out and the boot process will continue. If you want to, you can shorten this time so that it only waits for you for like 10 seconds rather than 30, because I think the default is 30. But you may not want to, because you might want to have plenty of time to press that down arrow key to boot into whichever operating system you're interested in booting into.
How do you
if you only
that?
Have one
I change that on one of my machines.
I think you can do that in the BIOS, actually. Change boot.ini's time?
No. You change that in system properties, in startup.
No, you go in the INI and you
do
that.
Yeah, you can do it in the system properties. It'll let you do it down to, I think, 3 seconds is the minimum it'll let you do.
If you've only got one operating system, it doesn't even wait.
No, it's just like, on we go. It'll just skip that step.
Oh, good, okay.
Next, NTLDR runs ntdetect.com, which gathers information about installed hardware. So the first thing that happens is post-tests, then your ntdetect.com gathers information about your hardware. After this, NTLDR finds the path specified in the boot.ini to locate the boot partition and launches two files that make up the core of the XP operating system, called ntoskrnl.exe, which is the kernel of the operating system, and hal.dll, hardware abstraction layer.dll. I believe these are also the core of the Vista and 7 operating systems as well. NTLDR reads the registry files, chooses a hardware profile, and loads the device drivers. There's a little bit on the Windows registry here. The Windows registry files are really important. These files are recognized by their distinctive names, which begin with HKEY, followed by the name of the portion of the operating system that it controls. Every setting in Windows, from the background of the desktop and the color of the screen buttons to the licensing of applications, is stored in the registry. When you make changes to the control panel settings, file associations, system policies, or installed software, the changes are stored in the registry. Each user has a unique section of the registry. The Windows login process pulls system settings from the registry to reconfigure the system to the state it was in when you last turned on your computer. At this point, ntoskernel.exe, that was loaded earlier, takes over. This is the heart of the operating system. This file starts winlogin.exe, which allows you to log on to your computer. So that's the boot process. And there's a great diagram listing the registry keys and what they do. There are 5 of them, and you'll want to look at that, and you'll want to have a really good look at it if you're doing A+. Any questions on the boot process?
So you said this would help troubleshoot some, like say for instance, I've seen people have problems where their operating system suddenly will not boot properly, and this would help by determining where it's stopping at in the boot process.
Basically, yeah, you're going to be able to tell at what point, if you understand the boot process, you're going to be able to understand what at what point this is stopping at. Because if you pass post, you know that your basic hardware is probably okay and you've got another problem. If you get to WinLogin, you know that it's booting fine, but there's some weird corruption in the actual operating system itself.
Is it worth noting that the average BIOS mem test misses 90% of memory errors? So keep that in mind as well.
Whoa.
Yeah,
Wow.
I've seen plenty of posts just go cruising through the memory, and then you run a memory test on it, and it screams errors all the way across the board. So good to know that memory test is reliable, which is why Windows has got one and Linux has got one now. You can test memory with a
Isn't
Windows
there a
disk.
way to go and tell it to do slow down and do a more thorough memory test in some instances? Because I think maybe the quick one doesn't do as good a job. Because I think there is a way to
There is,
tell some
but
biases to.
it still misses. It'll catch more of them, but it'll still miss a lot of them. But yes, you can go in and turn off quick power on self-test, and nobody wants to wait for their computer to boot up. We all want it now, which is why everybody
This
turns
computer
quick
takes
power on
so long,
self-test
I
on.
actually wouldn't mind waiting a little bit more.
Mine too. It's an old machine.
Yeah, same
But
here.
yeah, that sort of works for that. But yeah, keep that in mind that it will miss a lot of them. The other thing is there is a thing called what's it called? It'll show you. You press F8 and it brings up a menu, and you can actually show a logged startup, so you can actually see the thing scroll past as it boots up, and that will show you exactly where the boot falls over, because you can actually read
Yeah,
where
that
the
is
screen
there.
freezes.
Ah, yes.
That's what I need to have my friend Erica do and see what hers is doing.
I've got some people I need to do that too.
That seems pretty handy.
I'm not sure how you do it, but there is actually a method of getting Windows to dump its blue screen at a serial port if you still have one of those antiquated things. I'll have to look into that,
Oh,
because
I
I
think.
think you can actually dump those logs and stuff out the serial port.
Quite handy.
Absolutely. Any other questions on our boot sequence? Okay, cool. Now that we've booted the computer, it's time to configure it. There are many utilities in Windows that allow you to customize your computer. This is just a quick overview of some of them. You'll see a lot of them in your labs. MSConfig allows you to choose which programs and services start when you log onto Windows and allows you to edit configuration files. You'll have seen this in Lab 5.4.8. You'll also have seen RegEdit, which allows you to edit your registry. If you are editing the registry, always take a backup first, because if you make, pardon me, a mistake in the registry, it can cause lots of problems, and you may even have to reinstall the OS. MS32 displays a complete system summary of your computer, including hardware components details, installed software, and settings.
What?
What?
MS32 is it SysInfo32?
MSInfo32.
Ah, because I just typed MS32 into the run dialog and it wasn't there. I'm just like, I haven't
No,
seen that one
MSInfo
before.
32. No.
Someone's paying attention.
DXDiag is a utility that shows details about all of the DirectX components and drivers that are installed in your computer. You can use this utility to ensure that DirectX is installed and configured correctly. It'll basically, in 5.4.8, hold your hand and will walk you through these tests, so you do get to do this. Does anyone
That's
remember
cool.
having to use this program to fix Grizzly Gulch?
Do you
I
mean
never had to use
fix
it. It always
or
works.
cheat with?
No. Well, either.
I
Both.
never cheated with mine.
Oh.
I
Didn't
think
cheat with
Grizzly
mine
Gulch
either.
just
Wait, how do
worked
you
on my
cheat?
hardware.
Yeah,
Oh,
mine
it's
too,
an audio
honestly.
game. If you had to use
No.
DirectDiac, you had serious problems with your machine, like
I did
$100
actually.
Sonya.
Actually, I had to do it because if one of the settings wasn't right, if you tried to shoot anything, it would just freeze and the game would die. But I also found a setting
Ah.
to I also found a setting to make your enemies come at you slower and give you more time to shoot at them.
Oh, I need the
So,
snakes to go back and do that.
so you could slow it down so you'd have like a good 3 seconds to shoot instead of
I'm
like the half a
coming
second.
to get you. Oh, no, you're
No,
not.
it didn't slow him down. It just slowed down how much time you
Too
had to
bad.
shoot.
That'd be funny if it
So,
did.
that was pretty cool.
I
All
wonder
the
if I can
enemies
make that run
joined.
on Windows 7.
I should go home
I
and
don't
try it
know.
just for fun.
It
That's the
should run in
problem.
XP
Yeah.
compatibility mode. See last week's lecture, actually.
Yeah. That was a really fun game.
Oh, it was.
I never
CMD
played it.
allows. Oh.
Meh.
I never even heard of it.
Oh my. Okay. It's a wild out west, basically live voice acted, Western game.
Basically,
Blind
yeah, there was
game.
the whole audio games resolution that I think half of the blind community didn't get onto, so we missed out on Troopenum and Tank Commander and Shades of Doom and all those sorts of things. So that might be a Thursday chat one week, I think.
When did this come out? I mean, was this, of course,
In the
I.
90s.
This
Oh,
is
that
old.
explains it. I wasn't blind
Oh,
then.
it wasn't that old, was it?
Early 2000s, at
Grizzly
least.
Culture's like 2000 at least, I think. 2002, I think.
Yeah. No, I don't. Was it? Yeah, 2000 maybe. Yeah,
Yeah,
okay.
I think it was.
Fair enough. All right. Back to our lecture. No, really fun game. CMD allows you to execute commands from the command line and run command-based applications. There are many different modes in which you can boot Windows. We can press. Yeah, this is a new section, and I didn't head it, which now I've done. There we go. There are many different modes in which you can boot Windows. Press F8 to access Windows Advanced Boot Menu. Here are some common startup modes. Safe mode starts Windows, but only loads drivers for basic components such as keyboard and display. Safe mode with networking supports win sorry starts Windows identically to safe mode and also loads the drivers for networking components. And we've got safe mode with command prompt, which starts Windows and loads the command prompt instead of the GUI. Safe mode only loads essential drivers. Unfortunately, sound is not considered essential, so safe mode is not accessible.
Hang on, somebody
Triple
correct me
talk
if I'm wrong here,
PCI it
but
is.
I believe that Windows Server 2008 doesn't consider sound essential either. Oh, he would have been able to tell me
I
too.
don't
Oh well.
know.
Yeah, as far as I recollect, you don't actually get sound by support by default on Windows Server. You've actually got to put it on. So there's another gotcha for you.
Ouch.
Well, seriously, Sean, why
Yeah.
do you need sound on a server?
Well,
Here we
you
go,
actually
he's
don't.
back.
Oh, you
Oh, you're
can.
back. We can ask him.
Does Windows Server 2008 install sound by default? I didn't think it did. Or was that 2003 that didn't stick sound in by default?
Oh, it installs it all right. But what it does is it installs it and turns it off. And
Cool.
periodically, when you reboot, it'll just be off because it decided that you didn't really need it.
Oh, good of it to make that assumption.
Hardware speech is still very useful.
Oh yeah, that's what I was just
Yep.
gonna say. I've used mine in safe mode
Absolutely.
with double talks.
We've got last known good configuration, which enables a user to load configuration settings with Window that were used the last time Windows was started successfully.
I saw that work once. I couldn't believe it. I nearly died.
Me too. Me too.
It does this
Yeah,
by
I have
accessing a
too.
copy. Yeah, I've seen it of the registry that is created for this purpose. Now, this is why people are saying I saw that work once because last known good configuration is not useful unless it is applied immediately after the failure occurs. So if you're turning on your computer, you just bash that KKKKK key. Because if the machine restarts and manages to open Windows, the registry key for last known good configuration will be will probably be updated with the faulty information, and it won't work. So you've got one shot at last known good configuration.
KKK key, what are you talking about?
K. K is what you press for last known good configuration.
Oh. I didn't know that. Okay. Known. Did that say here?
It doesn't say that. It expects you to go through the F8 menu, but you can just hit K.
Oh.
And bash K until it
just
goes.
Just a trick. It's a little trick you learned from
without
the
doing the F8.
Yeah.
No, you'd have to do F8. You have to do F8 to pull the extended menu up, and then you press K.
Oh, okay. I thought you could, on some computers you could press K.
We'll have to Google that up, but as far as I know, every time you can press K for last known good, but
I think I've seen the menu come up. Yeah, I think I've seen the menu actually come up once because I was having some trouble with a machine and it wasn't booting, and that's the menu that was coming up. So it did come up by itself. Apparently, it realized there was an error somewhere.
Yeah,
and it
if that menu comes up by itself, I think we got problems.
Yeah, just a bit. All right, quick review. You guys probably already know this already, so preaching to the choir. Windows uses a directory tree to manage files and folders. The root of this tree is usually called C. Windows creates a set of default files and folders in C. However, did you guys know that you have the ability to create your own folders and organize them however you like? Yeah.
You wouldn't think so if you saw Crisis Root directory.
I was going to say, not all people know they have the ability to be organized about it. I do, and
no,
I'm
not
still
all
not
people
very
use the ability
about.
To. Yeah, mm-hmm. I know it doesn't mean I practice it. Actually, I sort of do. So. Yeah.
One caveat about 7, you actually can't write into the root directory if with UACT turned on, it won't let you.
No, you're right. That's
what?
Right. I remember seeing a friend of mine try that, and he's like, "I'll just throw it in there," and he wouldn't do it.
No, you cannot write to the root directory with UACT turned on. So, yeah, that's the anti-grace
mode. I think
that's
a good thing.
So do I.
Yeah, but then I just turn my UACT off and just I'm done with it and
continue to do it. Okay,
right to the
yeah,
fair enough.
Because I'm horrible.
Fair enough. That has a drawback too. If you try and, you know, UACK off is neat, except if something needs elevated privileges and can't ask you to get them because you've turned it off, occasionally things will break, i.e. installing Kurzweil and things actually won't work properly with UACK turned off.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Actually registering Kurzweil, you have to run as administrator the first time you do it to make it go. And MiraSpeak.
That's actually a good point. That if you're always in that, oh, I don't know whether I should run this as admin or not, I guess having UACK on does sort of make you think more about that. And I hadn't thought about that, but I think you have a point.
Oh, absolutely. For a lot of people, it's a good thing.
Because then
for
you don't
me,
have
it
to
just
be mystified as to when you have to run as an admin for a program and when you don't. Because I always see Windows
and if
7
I have trouble
doing that.
Yeah. If I have trouble installing something, I always think, oh, wait, admin? Do we need admin? If something won't install, if something won't register, I'll just make it run as admin, and that usually fixes it.
Remember the time we installed Top Speed and you told it to run as admin and you ended
And it was on UACK.
And it was on UACK and it actually tripped you up because UACK would have done it for you anyway and it ended up tying itself in knots.
Yeah, because you told her to run it as admin.
I think the biggest thing that turns us all off UACK, and UACK isn't too bad, but the biggest thing that turns us off UACK is where it goes and then sits there for 22 seconds with Narrator before it decides it's talking again.
I had JAWS going and it didn't do that, but I had never launched Narrator to start with.
7 is significantly better for A, the keystroke is always consistent. It's always Alt Y. It's not sort of, okay, is it allowed?
Alt C or Alt A or
yes,
whatever.
Or
continue. And you can customize it somewhat.
Yep, that percent slider is really customizable. You got four options, and probably have to troll through Technic to find out what they even
better know. Better than no options?
Well, it's better than no options. It's better than on or off.
Because I see that link that says change how these notifications, when these notifications occur or something. In my brief usage of 7.
Okay, so we're going to go over naming conventions for files. It used to be in DOS that you could only have 8-character-long file names with 3-letter extensions. So the 8.3 convention.
I saw this amazing ad for Windows 95. And in the left-hand pane, it had a picture of File Manager, and it said lfoyd.doc, and it had DOS, Windows 3.1. And then in the right-hand pane, it had long file name of your dreams.doc, Windows 95.
Oh! Classic.
Okay. The rules of this naming convention are very testable in A+, and are the following. Maximum of 255 characters can be used. Characters such as a slash or backslash are not allowed. An extension of 3 or 4 characters is added to the file name to identify the file type. Now, if you don't see a file extension on a computer, why would this be?
They're hidden, yeah.
They're hidden. And you want to unhide them for security purposes.
I think that's the most stupid thing that 98 ever did.
And for your sanity.
Extensions.
Yeah, and for your sanity. Well, you know what? They may not be shown because they're little pictures for the sighted people to tell you what these things are.
However, that breaks when you've got pif.exe because it shows the wrong picture. It doesn't show the exe picture, it shows the pif picture.
Right, so that's why you need to have it on for security.
Yeah, I remember my first copy of Windows 98 thinking, why is there no file name extensions? And then I realized that you had to actually go in and set all that. And it was my first time I'd ever seen that. It was quite interesting. I was quite annoyed that every copy of Windows since then has had it hidden like that by default.
It was felt that file extensions would confuse users. Microsoft's user, like Happy Brigade, just thought that because we had file extensions, it would just be too complex. And, you know, you just should be able to call your file, you know, letter to Janet, and you shouldn't have to worry about what sort of file it was. Yeah, well.
Yeah, that's helpful. Okay, file names in Windows are not case sensitive, which is different to everything else, because normally they are case sensitive. The following file name extensions are commonly used.
Hang on, .doc or case sensitive.
No, it's not.
No.
Hang on.
But Linux is.
Isn't the Mac case insensitive in the Finder, but case sensitive in the CLI, if my memory serves?
Yes, I believe so.
Oh, how inconsistent. I'd tear my hair out.
That would take a while. There's a lot of it.
There's so much hair.
And the other thing is, when you format the drive, if you're not careful, one of the choices is Mac OS X Extended Journal Case Sensitive.
It is. Yes, it is.
Some utilities actually need that.
Be careful.
Because a lot of Unix utilities want Makefile with a capital M. Otherwise, they don't go.
Oh, I don't know. I made this not.
The following file name extensions are commonly used. .dot or .docs, Microsoft Word, .txt, ASCII text file only, JPG, graphic format, PPT or PPTX, Microsoft PowerPoint, .zip, compression format. Okay, next section. The directory structure contains a set of attributes for each file that controls how the file can be viewed or altered. These are the most common file attributes. An R, this is a read-only file. The file, the file will be archived the next time that the disk is backed up. S, the file is marked as a system file and a warning is given if an attribute if an attempt is made to delete or modify the file. H, the file is hidden in the directory display. You can view file names, extensions, and attributes by entering the attrib command in a command line window.
Just a hint, guys, they're in that order because it spells the word rash, just so you can remember them.
Alright.
Once we get into the command line, you're going to be able to navigate to the folder. Now, what command are we going to use to navigate to the folder of the file we want to see the attribute of?
Come on, paper, we did it last week. Give you a clue, the music industry makes lots of money on these.
CD.
CD.
Well done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, Maria. Alright, so once we do this, we're going to type attrib followed by the file name. So attrib space your file name. You can use wildcards such as *.* to view many files at once. The attribute of each file appear in the left column of the screen. To get information about the attrib command, you can type the following at the command prompt, attrib/?. You can access the GUI equivalent of attrib by right-clicking a file in Windows Explorer and choosing properties. But remember, in order to do this, you're going to need to enable show hidden files and folders in Windows Explorer. If you don't know how to do this, consult your notes because they tell you exactly how to do it.
Also, Alt-Enter is the shortcut for properties, which I'm sure you all know by now.
Remember that Windows XP uses both NTFS and FAT32 file systems. You can also, on Vista and 7, use thumb drives that have FAT32. NTFS handles more and bigger files, provides compression, encryption, and better security settings. You can convert a FAT file system to an NTFS file system by using the convert.exe utility. Back up your data before doing this. It should keep your data intact, but you should do this as a precaution. Be sure you want an NTFS file system, because you must reformat the partition to get it back to FAT32 if you change your mind. So you really need to want this to happen, which you probably do. Have a look at the two diagrams showing the file property dialogs for a FAT32 file and an NTFS file. You get to do a cool lab using Convert in Chapter 12. So you'll get to convert a FAT32 partition over to an NTFS one and compare all the file properties, and it's very neat to do. This may be a near test. I don't think it is this year. But there you go. Alright, can someone please tell me what a GUI is?
Graphical User Interface?
That's right. It's a graphical user interface. It's graphical. It's your desktop. It's point, click, or use your arrow keys. So if that is a GUI, what's a CLI?
Type it in.
Command line interface.
Oh, okay. Maria, you can just basically jump in. There's not enough of us to warrant using the chat today.
Okay, no worries.
Alright. Yep, command... okay. Yep, it's going to be the command line interface. A desktop on a computer is a graphical representation of a workspace. It can be customized to suit your needs and preferences. The images, sounds, and colors that you use to customize your desktop are known collectively as a theme. Windows Vista and 7 have a special theme called Aero, spelled A-E-R-O, not A-R-R-O-W. Aero is the default theme and has translucent windows, borders, numerous animations, and live icons that are thumbnails images of the contents of the file.
Isn't that Aero?
It'd be
it's
aero,
aero,
like aerodynamic.
Yeah, it's aero.
Nobody
as in
says it that
space,
way, though.
Aero
Nobody says it that way. In America, you'll find that people just kind of blend.
Do they fly on aeroplanes, do they?
No, it's an airplane.
Oh, okay, because we have aeroplanes
here,
over
here. It's
here.
An airplane.
Airplane.
It's an airplane.
It's my. That's why the song "It's My Aeroplane" by Red Hot Chili Peppers is so amusing over here, because nobody says it that way.
Yeah. yeah, it's aero. Is how it should be pronounced, but
aero
there you
system
go.
Technology turns it off.
Yes,
bye.
I was going to say that. Bye.
And thank goodness for that.
Oh yeah. Because of its advanced graphics needs, aero can only be used on computers that meet certain hardware requirements. Screen readers disable Aero by default, and Windows Vista Basic and Windows 7 Starter do not include it. Windows 7 has added some additional features to the Aero theme, which I found interesting. These include Shake, minimize all windows not being used by clicking a window and shaking the mouse. To maximize the window again, click the same window and shake the mouse. You've got Peek. View the icons and gadgets on the desktop by pointing the mouse at the right edge of the taskbar to make all windows transparent.
Just a question for those of us on it. Does Zoom Text turn off Aero as well? I would assume it does.
I believe so.
Don't use
okay,
Zoom
we'll
Text,
to...
I wouldn't know.
No, I don't use it.
Brian, do you know?
No, I think if you install a mirror driver of any description, it turns it off.
Yeah, I kind of thought so. Cause
yeah, that would stand
it
to reason.
Because seriously, Aero would rock Zoom Text world and just make it absolutely really hard to use magnification.
Yeah, you didn't mean that in a good way, did you? Of course not.
No, I mean, it just messed it up royally.
Yeah, just checking.
Yeah. Snap! This resizes a window by dragging it to one of the edges of the screen. If you drag the window left, it fits the window to the left half of the screen. Same thing if you drag it to the right. If you take it to the top, it maximizes the window to fill the entire screen. If you drag it to the bottom, I believe it will just minimize it, and it's gone.
Why didn't I just call this theme Eye Candy?
Basically. That's exactly what it
years
is.
Ago, I was using Windows 3.1, and they used to have it where you could move the frames of the screens around and whatever. But if you move if you took the thing and moved it down, like say on a 45 degree angle to the bottom right, and you accidentally let go of the mouse button, it would snap that sucker up to the left hand right, and you could barely get there'd be barely like a little screen sitting out there. And there was one time that it snapped so far up there I could not get the screen back. I had to like reboot the computer and hope it came back. It was weirdest thing. It's like a rubber
oh,
band, you
man.
Know. Yeah, it was terrible.
That's
it's like
crazy.
If you moved it down and you accidentally left it go, it would just like snap and boom, it would go up. And there would be like this little quarter inch by quarter inch little corner sticking up in the left hand corner. Yeah. It was frustrating.
That's awesome.
Oh, terrible.
Does anybody remember when you used to be able to get... I think you can still do it under newer Windows, but if you're really careful and you're sighted, you can get all the icons and pile them up one on top of the other so that there's one icon in the middle of your screen, and then when you drag them all off, the other icons show up.
I had to teach my dad about lock the taskbar because he got... I don't know if he got... if it got really skinny or really huge, but... It did one or the other. And I said, okay, when you get it where you want it, right-click it and hit lock. For heaven's sake.
Yay.
The weight industry
it's
has
shrinking,
met your taskbar.
Shrinking. In Windows Vista, there is also a sidebar that you can customize. This contains little programs called gadgets that can be things such as clocks, sticky notes, and access to web interfaces such as social networking and games. And as Vanessa says, oh yeah, that's annoying.
No, there's also a currency converter that's actually useful. We talked about that last year.
Yeah.
I think there was a Twitter, there were a couple of Twitter things. So yeah, it's social networking, like you said.
She's not a fan of the sidebar.
But
she's
she probably hasn't actually gone and looked at any of the third-party ones either. And if you've seen the default Microsoft ones, you do tend to phooey it off and just go, "Dah, sidebar." But there's actually some quite good ones that people have released that are actually quite useful. It's a bit like the accelerators in Internet Explorer. Has any of us gone in and seen any of the other accelerators you can have in IE 8 Plus? Not me.
No, I don't even know what they're.
I don't even really know what
honestly.
They're supposed to do.
They're extra things in the right-click menu, so rather than save target as, you can blog with Windows Live and send via carrier pigeon and stuff like that.
Fair enough.
Just more shortcuts to slap in there, right?
Yeah, okay.
Hey, I love
send
my send to MP3.
Carrier pigeon.
I found the best thing to do with this sidebar is to turn it off. That is for one of the first things I do after I turn off UAC in Vista. There goes the sidebar. Go away. Windows 7 has gotten rid of this loveliness called the sidebar, and it allows you to place gadgets anywhere on the desktop instead of having a sidebar. If you're interested in doing this and know how...
If people wanted it, they could get it back.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. If you're interested in how to do this... The notes have instructions for you and all the ways you can move and align these gadgets. But honestly, it's all in the notes and you can read about it if you feel inclined. Okay, to customize Windows XP GUI of your desktop, right-click the desktop and choose Properties. The Display Properties window has five tabs.
Just themes, a point here. Mm-hmm. Make sure nothing is selected when you right-click this desktop or you will not get this menu. Because lots of people go, my computer, and then they right-click and wonder why the actual thing doesn't pop up. So make sure you control space to unselect everything and then right-click for your properties.
That's a good point, yeah. A lot of people do.
You want to get out of the habit of using F5. Because in Windows 7 there is no F5 and control space is the way to do it. And I didn't know that until last year. And I'm like, so that's how you do it.
I've always done control space.
F5
is
refresh. It's never been unselect everything. That was just an
unintended
side effect.
I think it unselects as you... Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't do that anymore in Windows 7. So the proper thing to do is control space.
That's okay. I've wanted to smack multiple students over the years for typing CD dot dot at a command prompt without putting the space. So there are all those little things we get into the habit of doing that eventually come back and bite us.
Okay, so we've got five tabs. Themes, desktop, screensaver, appearance, and settings. Click any of these tabs to customize your display settings. In Windows Vista and 7, right-click desktop and choose personalize. The personalization window of Vista has seven links, and they've gotten rid of all... Well, you'll see a lot more links in Windows 7 and Vista, and they're kind of weird links, too, because they're picky about what buttons you press. Some links like space, some links like enter, but many of them don't like both. So you'll sit there and you'll click them, and you'll wonder why in the world they aren't doing what you think they are. So if that happens to you, try the other key, and it will probably magically work. So, we've got window color and appearance, desktop background, screensaver, sound, mouse pointers, themes, and display settings. Click any of these links to customize your display settings. In Windows 7, you get three links on the left. Those are change desktop, icons, mouse pointers, and your account picture. Themes are chosen from the right panel. You can modify a theme's background, color, sound, and screensaver using the four items under the window. I don't even have any idea what this looks like. I couldn't even tell you guys. Because basically for us it's a you hit tab to go through all these links. So I don't really have a good picture of what this looks like.
And that's the problem with links, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically just a list of you know, tab around links for us. You just go around and around until you find what you want. And I just could.
And they don't
have no
hotkeys,
idea what this
do
looks
they?
Like on the screen. I don't think they do.
No, they don't.
So
that increases efficiency
either.
Too.
Yeah.
That's okay, because FS will invent one for us in JAWS 15.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
they'll just like
all of the links.
They probably don't even use the virtual cursor when you're in dialogues. I haven't used Windows Vista or something.
No,
so
they
I
don't.
Have no, idea.
No, they don't. And let's just hope it doesn't have any place markers in it, because I think we're all done with that debate.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, don't even say that. We'll get sued.
Sorry, place markers, TM, Freedom Scientific, TM, TM, Patent of Freedom Scientific, TM, 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 place markers.
Why do you think
okay.
the Mac
oh,
called
we
it
might
Web
have covered
Spots?
It.
Which, actually, Web Spots is kind of a cool name for it.
That is kind of a cool term. Alright, to customize any item on the desktop, right-click it when it's selected and select Properties. Alright.
Did people
any
know...
Question?
That you can actually change the first icon on your desktop to not be my computer or whatever. You can actually change it. So if you want
to
play with that, there's something you can do.
At work, or even my documents, when you hit home.
Yeah, a lot of people liked that back in 98, I think.
You can still do it in XP and a lot of it in 7 with Tweak UI.
Oh, one thing about...
7?
Oh.
I believe so.
I think there is a 7 version of Tweak UI, yeah.
Okay, one thing you want to know... About Windows 7 and Vista, there's no more classic menus in Windows 7. So you will need to
hang on,
actually...
Wait. The thing that's on my friend's laptop does give you the start menu, the little thing that the VA wrote that says, give me my classic start menu so that the blind veterans won't freak out. So yes, there is
shell.
Something written out there. Okay.
Okay,
actually,
yeah, you could do that.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Quick question.
No,
actually,
I wish I was.
You know how... You know, and somebody may know the answer to this, you know how in Windows XP and stuff you used to be able to drop files into a directory and then they would turn up down the bottom of your Explorer window or your My Computer window or whatever?
Yeah.
Does anybody know how you stop Windows 7 from auto-refreshing the folder? Because it has a habit of just doing that. It goes, oh, there's new stuff, I'll resort it for you, there you go.
Oh, no.
I wonder if Tweak UI has that.
If you find it, I want to know about it, because it was
look
very
in
handy the
folder
way it was.
Is there folder options?
No,
I've poked through everything in folder options to find it.
Yeah, we might have to have a look on annoyances.org, because it automatically refreshes, but sometimes if you're working off a network share, it won't refresh it, and then you suddenly get hopeful that it's not actually going to refresh it, and then the next folder does, and you're sent back into a crashing depression as you realise that, no, you're not going to be able to see the folders that you recently added to the end of the folder list, because it's going to refresh on you. Yeah, it drives a lot of people... You can laugh, Grace, but it drives a lot of people mental.
No, I don't. Oh,
that would drive me
like
nuts.
It.
No, that'd drive me crazy.
I like it.
The other drawback, I've seen it with network shares where I've deleted something and it doesn't go away.
Oh, I know. Like Dropbox is famous for that.
Actually, I've seen a bug with Dropbox. I hope it's fixed in 1.0.28, where you delete something out of a folder and then Explorer falls over and then relaunches, and then when you finally go back into Dropbox, it is actually gone. But it just it's very strange.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so if you want to have icons on your desktop, such as computer, documents, network, control panel, all of that, you're going to need to go into your personalization and select icons, or desktop icons, I think it is. Something about icons. Click it, and you're going to have to check these things that you want on your desktop, or else you won't have them. Okay. The Start menu displays all of the applications installed in the computer, a list of recently opened documents, and a listing of other elements, such as a search feature, help center, system settings, and, your shutdown and stuff. To access it, To access it from anywhere in Windows, press the Start button. The XP-style Start menu is used throughout this course for demonstrating command sequences. I'll be telling you about classic commands as well when we actually talk about Windows XP, because that's what I use, so you will get both. Windows 7 has removed Start menu styles so that you have to use the Windows 7 Start menu, which isn't bad at all, and you'll get used to, and is quite good, actually.
You will get used to it. You don't have a choice. Just suck it up and deal, unless you want to install Classic Shell.
What's a quick way? I have trouble when I get new people, because I can't make sense of how the program's tree view works. It seems to start with recently used things, and somewhere in there is something that looked like all programs. And because I use the search thing all the time, because I can just do that faster, I don't actually know how to navigate the Start menu with a keyboard.
What actually happens...
Okay, here's what you do.
When you first pop it up, you've got to understand, just before Grace explains it, that it takes a little bit of time for the Start menu to settle. So the classic things will pop up first, but you've got to wait about another half a second before that All Programs things actually comes up and stabilizes. That's what I've noticed.
What you're going to do is you've got the search box, which kind of seems to me like it's smack in the middle of the screen. If you press your down arrow, you're going to get your most recently used programs. If you press your up arrow, you're going to find the All Programs menu. You can press right arrow to open it, and then it's going to just act like the All Programs menu always has.
And don't forget that Tab gives you nifty stuff too. That takes you to another section of the Start menu where some of your other stuff is...
No, I'm wrong. Hold on.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. But, like, for example, today somebody wanted shutdown, and I found it, but it was a series of sort of poking around and guessing at things. And
easiest way to shut down is Alt-F4 on the desktop, in my experience.
I tell you what confused me there is I found shutdown in the Start menu, and I hit space, and it shut down, and I hit Enter, and it shut down. And it turns out what you have to do is actually hit the right arrow... so that you can pop open that menu and choose whether you want to restart or what. So yeah, all F4 from the desktop would be easier.
Wow. Man, I need to get into 7. It sounds way, way, way different.
It is very different.
It is, but different. There's so many better things about it that it's worth this little minor trivial...
Can we help you with something, Elise, or are you just...
What's up, Elise?
Just popping in just to demonstrate what this Ventrilo cape is all about. Don't mind me.
Okay, no problem. I can't get that to work correctly. I don't know what you're supposed to do with that, but if you go down through your recent programs, it starts to give you the list of all the rest of it. Like, once you get to the bottom of the programs you've recently used, you'll start seeing 7-zip and keep going down. So I thought it looked like it's a submenu, so I tried to hit the right arrow, and it didn't exactly do what you'd think the right arrow should do. So I don't really know. Alright. Windows 7 has also added some new features to the taskbar. You've got a jump list to display a list of tasks that are unique to the application. Right-click its icon in the taskbar, pinned applications. To add an application to the taskbar for easy access, right-click the icon of an application and select pin to taskbar. Does anyone actually use this? Is this useful for blind people?
I've used that, and actually XP has that too. I usually assign you can assign hotkeys too within there. So I don't even use the menu system, but yeah, I've used that before.
I think you can get to them by Windows T and Windows Shift T. Will take you backwards and forwards through the things you've pinned to the taskbar. So for a lot of people, that's quicker.
Fair enough.
Weird.
We have
like a dock.
Basically,
much.
Yeah.
Without the inconvenience of VOF2 twice quickly.
Thumbnail previews. To view a thumbnail image of the window, hover the mouse over the taskbar icon. Not really useful to us, but there you go. To access the various drives installed in the computer, double-click the My Computer icon that appears on the desktop. To customize certain settings, right-click My Computer and choose Properties. This is basically going to bring you into your System Settings menu. Settings that you can customize include computer name, hardware settings, virtual memory, automatic updates, remote access.
Just another tip, guys, Windows pause break will work since Windows 95 and works all the way through to Windows 7.
I love that keystroke.
In Windows Vista and 7, my computer is called computer. My has gone away in these operating systems, so you have documents, network, instead of my documents and my network
Thank
places.
God.
That's nice.
Yeah, it just is a lot
my, cleaner. My music, my videos, my this, my that, my soul.
My. I know it's mine. It's on my it's on the my PC.
My actually, no. No, the reason they got rid of it, there was a very good reason for this, is because when you're actually logged into a terminal server and you're logged into a company computer, the My Computer icon doesn't open up your computer at all. It opens up theirs, which is why they changed it. Because if you're actually running on a Citrix remote session, it's not yours at all.
Well, it certainly makes it easier so that there's fewer M's on my desktop.
That too.
Go through.
Yeah, you just want to hit V for videos and D for documents.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Absolutely. To customize certain settings, click the Start button, then right-click Computer and choose Properties. Alright. In Windows 7, you must also click Advanced System Settings. Access installed drives in Vista and 7 with the following path. Start, Computer, or just stick it on your desktop. Windows 7 adds the following features to Windows Explorer. Search box. Access previous searches. You can also filter search results. We've got a new folder button, which creates a new folder with one click, which is pretty awesome. Arrange by organizes items easily according to different criteria. This is good for finding the one, you know, exe file in a group of all sorts of stuff that you accidentally put into your music collection. Preview pane button turns on the preview pane on or off as needed. Now we've got a section on Windows libraries, which is new and confuses a lot of people. So, libraries is a new Windows feature that allows you to easily organize content from various storage devices on your local computer and network, including removable media, without actually moving the files. A library is a virtual folder that presents content from a different location within the same view. You can search a library and you can filter the contents using criteria such as author, date, modified, or tag. When Windows 7 is installed, you get four default libraries: documents, music, pictures, and videos. To access a library, open any folder and click Libraries in the left column. To add a file or folder to a library, right-click it and choose Include in Library, and then choose which library to add the item. The file or folder will be available when you open that library. You can create new libraries. You can open a folder and use the following path. Libraries, New Library. To customize a library, right-click the library and click Properties. The Properties window allows you to add folders to the library by clicking Include a Folder. You can also change the icon for the library and customize how items can be arranged in that library.
For anyone who cares, they're actually an XML file that you can actually edit if you feel that way inclined, and that's how the Windows keeps track of what's in what
library.
Do
you guys actually use them?
I do to a certain extent. One of the problems with libraries is that you can get files out of a library, and when you actually save files, it saves it into the location that you pulled the file out of. But you can't actually copy files into a library because it won't know where to put it.
I think it would confuse me more than actually help me.
It kind of acts like a playlist, doesn't it? I mean, where it just basically points to where the actual file was located.
It's basically a pointer.
It's like if you've got C:\mp3s, D:\nicked-from-my-friends\mp3s, and E:\torrented-from-the-government\mp3s, and you want to put those three folders together into, you know, MP3 library.
All right. Launching applications. Yeah, let's insult your intelligence. To launch applications, press enter on them or double click them. We'll talk about my network places a bit, or network. This is where all of your network shares are going to be, as long as SAMP is working correctly. Does anyone have any questions about how that works?
We could have a 2-hour lecture on how network places works.
If,
or doesn't work.
Yeah.
I was just going to say.
Most of the time, the reason it doesn't work, and I'm just going to point this out very quickly, is because you didn't set the same work group on all your computers like I told you to. So make sure your work group is set. Make sure that you've got user accounts and the same passwords across all of the computers, and then try using network places. Okay? Okay. I'm done.
How do I get rid of old network places?
Delete them
files
out of NetHood.
That aren't even on the...
Okay, delete them out of NetHood.
But I'll do it again.
No, just go under your Documents and Settings, Sean folder, and then under NetHood, just smash the shortcuts and they're gone.
Ah, okay. I thought I did that once, but I'll do it again.
Seven is actually a lot smarter about sort of discovery and finding things that sometimes aren't on the same work group.
Yeah.
XP used to break all the time, but 7 actually is a lot better. I don't know what they changed, but its discovery is a lot more stable and actually finds things pretty consistently.
Except when you have Samba with multiple Linux servers and it breaks. And it's bad, but one other thing
it's weird. It finds my Samba based. I have a Synology network attached storage thing and a D-Link attached storage thing, which consequently works better than the Synology. It's not supposed to work that way because it was significantly cheaper.
No.
And the shares on those, I mean, I have the same problem we talked about last night about speed, where the performance and copying stuff from them is awful, but finding them seems to be a not issue. Now, I wonder if it's because I don't have user accounts on the LAN. Like, from outside, you need a user account.
I would say
on
so.
The local
Probably.
Subnet, it's
Probably.
Yeah, we actually found the problem that Grace is complaining about in that particular instance is there were actually two machines warring over who was going to be the master browser, and that was a bit complicated as to who was going to be the local master browser, and the browser lists were getting out of sync and stuff. That's fixed. Now I just can't...
Yeah, now it works pretty well now. Yeah, for printer issues, it's fun.
At least she's given up on installing Windows file servers into my computer room.
I never do see my HP Jet Direct card in Network Neighborhood. I'm not sure why, but it never appears. I just have to know its IP.
Well, guess we're not the only ones then.
I think you actually have to add it in as a printer and then add it in as a direct IP printer, and then you share the instance of that printer out from the workstation you've added it to. That's how you make it show up. Stupid, I know.
Yeah, I know with printers, Vista, I think I had a Vista and an XP or two Vistas or something, and I was looking at helping a friend set one up, and you had to actually make
a
copy of the printer, I believe.
Ow.
Yeah, a copy.
We do
of
not
the,
bounce.
She dropped us.
That was the Plantronics. Yeah. Yeah, she bounced that on the desk and it made
she
quite
dropped
a racket.
Us.
Yeah, but she had to actually make
she'll
a
be,
copy of it.
Of the printer.
Yeah, I think I still have the page, the web page on it, but it was definitely weird to share the printer. I think you had to do something. I'll have to go back and look at it, but whatever it was, it worked. It was to share a Vista printer.
Oh, it's because of the different
network,
drivers. Yes.
Yeah, you had to make it...
What are you trying to do? Share it?
You share it with multiple operating systems. If you've got Vista and XP, you've got to have two different instances of the printer, one with the Vista drivers, one with the XP drivers. Otherwise, you try...
I found that out
the
hard way,
the other one.
Now, if I could only share my XP printer from... If I could only get my Mac to see it, I would be happy, but...
Oh, okay. Me
you
too.
You can do that.
Me too. I'm not having my...
I tried, and it didn't... Well, I had to tell the Mac I was using a different model of printer than I actually was... And then
no, you've actually got to get the proper drivers, And you can actually customize it under cups in on the Mac with a custom print queue, and there will
except
be a filter
HP
to drive your XP
except
printer.
Except HP doesn't have drivers for it.
Then you use the other drivers that you can actually get from, like, fumatic.org and stuff. There are ways and means. They're not within the means of the average user, but you do actually end up with a copy of Cups on the Mac, and it's got a web interface from which you can configure it, and you can jiggle with all the print queues and all that sort of stuff. Really?
What I had done was told it I had a 1022. What I did is told it I had a 1022, and it went and then did software update because it's an HP LaserJet 1020, and then it fixed itself.
See, maybe
I found it on the net somewhere,
yeah,
and it worked.
Like it's just an HP 4050, sort of one of those four-tray. It's a long story, but I got it in trade for some work. Four trays and a big display and things. Everything I have, it just worked. Like, go look here, add an IP printer at 192.168.1.5, and it's an HP 4000, and away we go on every operating system I've tried.
Oh, the 4000s were good.
Oh, just as a matter of course, if anybody tells you that Lexmark is the printer you want to buy and it's under $300, run very fast the other way.
No.
Yeah, I never did like their stuff either.
The really expensive stuff is actually quite good. Like the ones that are like $600 and $700 with the network interfaces and stuff are absolutely amazing. But the one you get for $69 is not so amazing. And I remember people who used to print like CDs and stuff out at the swap meet. They literally used to buy the $69 printer, print it into the ground, and then dump the printer and its empty cartridges into the bin.
Wow.
Okay. Problem with these headsets, Grace?
Yeah. Jeez.
Oh, it was awful. You're like, I'll be back.
I'm so sorry.
I was like, she dropped us.
I just set it down.
Yeah, go and bring in the Sennheisers, seriously.
Through us.
She doesn't want to bring her Sennheisers into.
No, I really don't. These are cheap and decently block out sound. Okay, so we basically have all taken a jaunt into our control panel, right? We know basically how the control panel works. Does anyone not know how the control panel works and what it does?
Read your notes.
One thing I do want to talk to
you... In 7, it's all a bunch of tabby, linky things like you just described, right?
It is.
Yeah,
categorized, and there's no way to change
not,
it.
There's probably no list
you can do,
anymore.
You can do God mode, I guess, but...
no, I can't even bother.
Honestly, I don't even... Like, why would you bother? Because it's... You just tab around, and there it is.
That's if you can figure out exactly which of the six windows you're tabbing around in. The Windows 7 control panel is a dog's breakfast. It's really bad.
Ugh.
Yeah.
It's not so bad.
If you thought there was a list of 25 categories like there was in XP, dream again, because you're tabbing through the wonderland
even more.
Of Windows 7. Yeah, it's awful.
So you learn what these things are, and you type in the search box what you want, and you don't use the control panel.
Yeah.
You know, that's assuming you know all of the things that you actually need to access, and this was a point I was making a couple of
weeks
ago with
a friend. But
within
about 2 to 3 months, you do.
If you install a new program under Windows 7 and you don't know what that program installed the shortcut is, good luck finding it because you don't know what to type into the search box yet.
Yeah, I remember
that. So you look through your old programs
menu,
you find it.
Oh.
Yeah. The one thing I want to talk to you guys about is the Computer Management Console, which allows you to manage many aspects of both your computer and remote computers. The Computer Management Console addresses three main areas of administration. System tools, storage, and services and applications. You must have administrative privileges to access the Computer Management Console. To view the Computer Management Console, use the following path. Start, Control Panel, Administrative Tools, or Computer Management. To view the Computer Management Console for a remote computer, right-click the Computer Management Local in the console tree and click Connect to Another Computer. In the Another Computer box, type the name of the computer or click Browse to find a computer you want to manage. You have a lab on administrative tools. Did anyone have any trouble with that?
I'm actually having trouble with it now.
Yeah, I found that one really cool. Remember, you don't have to do the performance window stuff. You do everything else. But just if it says anything about the performance window, you just ignore that step. You don't ignore all of the steps. You just ignore those bits that say performance manager. You do all the network stuff to see how the services work. But that's about it.
Yeah, that's where I was getting hung, actually, in that freeze the display. And I never did find any of those.
Now, in the lovely accessibility documents thing, it will tell you not to worry about that.
Yeah, we keep mentioning that. Oh, pretty much.
Yeah, you want to read that thing. It's really, 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 really helpful.
You know, we'd post it to the mailing list 6 times, but you all still wouldn't read it.
Come on, guys. It will save you heartache and grief.
There was actually a list of how to label all those tools if you really wanted to do it. Brad did
that's
post
only
a
an
list
XP.
Of those. Well, he's only got XP. He doesn't have 7.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah, in XP, I guess it's somewhat durable.
Yeah, you don't have to, though. You can actually bypass that bit. But, yeah.
Basically, because I spent about an hour and a half sitting in front of 7 trying to make it do it, and I'm just like, oh, it won't work. I was really sad. Okay, we've got Device Manager. And we basically talked about that already today and how that works. Well, not today, last week. So if you have trouble, look in the notes. There's yet another section on it. You can always look at listen to Module 4. You can look earlier in Module 5 or listen to my lecture. So many options.
You know you are a real techie when you've actually made a shortcut to devmgmt.msc on your desktop and called it Device Manager with a hotkey of Control-Alt-D.
I should do that, actually. I go in there quite a bit.
Yeah. We've also got Task Manager. And that is Control-Shift-Escape if you do it the right way?
That's right.
I love
good.
It.
I actually remembered
it's
it
so
this
much
year.
Easier, and you can do it with one hand.
I have to train
well, see,
myself
I always,
out. Yeah. Alt control C and then
control
press
escape.
I use control escape for start menu all the time, and so shift was nothing.
Saves finding the Windows key.
Yeah, it does. It really does.
When you have a laptop like my old one, where it was in the top right hand corner or close to it.
Mm-hmm. I used to use Insert F6 all the times to minimize apps, and I was so disappointed when they took it away.
Oh.
Or they just took
Windows
it out of the
D
keyboard
is good
manager.
Though.
Windows
yeah.
D or Windows M
yeah.
will do.
Windows D isn't the same as Windows M. Windows, they actually do slightly different things.
Yeah.
They
Windows
do,
Windows D toggle flips to the desktop and back.
Task Manager allows you to monitor the performance of the CPU and virtual memory, view all processes that are currently running, and view information about the network connections.
Okay, quick poll here. Anybody dropped into Task Manager and gone, Task Manager, J, Alt, E, space, J, Alt, E, space, J, Alt, E, space, Control, Alt, N.
Yep, many times today.
Not quite that way.
Many times.
Yep.
My thing is, it's always in the Task Manager still, or you think it is, because it doesn't refresh and you don't know it. And then when it gives you an error, then you say, well, I guess it's already ended that task.
You can press F5 to refresh it and then to see whether it shows up again. But
Another thing you can do is go into your Task Manager and find, I think it's the processor, or resources that something's using, and sort your processes by how many resources they're using. And I like to do that to see what when my computer is all stuffed up, what in the world is using all of my resources?
Jaws.
Yeah, not
Twitter
generally.
With 100,000 tweets in your buffer.
Yeah. It's Twitter. whoa.
That's fixed if you're running from source. He doesn't hold them in memory anymore. They're just pulled from MongoDB. So, look forward to Twitter 5 people or run from source.
That was bad. Oh.
Yeah. Usually it's not JAWS, actually. It can be Internet Explorer. It can be a virus program.
Yeah, that's true.
It's the Skype toolbar quite regularly. Bits of Skype tend to chew your CPU for breakfast for no good reason. I'm Skype and I'm running. Say goodbye to your response
time. Yeah, basically. Because you want me to run. Services can be set to run automatically when Windows starts or manually when required. You can also disable services and make them not run. If you're going to do that, though, make sure you know what they are.
I used to use that little handy startup manager thing. I actually had a copy of it on a floppy once. It was fantastic.
I still have
that. Startup control panel.
One of the problems with MSConfig, and I was going to mention this, and a lot of people don't realize this, but if you go into MSConfig and customize what runs and what doesn't run, it actually sticks your computer in selective startup mode and leaves it there. And I've seen people's computers left that way for months. And then somebody goes in and in months' time and turns it back to regular and wonders why everything blows up sideways.
That's why it started doing that on me. I was wondering because I went in there and set some things and it came back and gave me a warning saying, you're in selective mode. You should want to be doing this. Yeah, it's like, now I get it.
Yep. No, you do probably want to do it. You just have to tell it, yes, I know, I did this. It's okay. Don't show me this again.
And then you forget. Yeah. And you don't realize you're in selective, and then you don't know why things don't start anymore because you forgot 3 months ago that you turned off, flobberworm.exe.
Yeah. You can go to use the services in the control panel. Go through the administrative tools, blah, blah, blah. Or you could just hit Windows R and type in services.msc, and there comes your services area. So much easier. For Windows 7, you can just type in services in the search box, and it will pop up. You've got the performance monitor, which is kind of inaccessible. You've got two distinct parts, system monitor and performance logs and alerts. The system monitor displays real-time information about the processes, disks, memories, and network usage for your computer. You can easily summarize these activities through histograms, graphs, and reports. Your performance logs and alerts, these are cool, and you will get to do a very tricky but very informative lab about this in Module 12, and you'll really want to get familiar with NVDA because it is the best way to do that particular lab. So alerts will notify you when a specific usage falls below or rises above a specified threshold, and you can set alerts to create entries in the event log, send a network message, begin a performance log, run a specific program, or any combination of these. Really powerful and really cool. And you'll need administrative privileges to access the performance monitor console. We've got a path. You guys can read that yourselves. And guys, get used to how these paths look and what they might be, because in your final, you'll have a few questions on paths.
I actually don't like, I have trouble with the way they do it, because for us, sometimes we don't, is this part of the path a tab? Is this part just a button? Is this part, start, control panel, modems, click modems, add, next, and finish.
I think the other thing, Sean, is press start, which is a button. A button is a thing that you can press, so you'll be pressing the button, which is the thing that you've pressed. Once you've pressed the button, now select the menu, which will be a slide-out arrowy thing that you'll drag.
No, I understand. It's just hard. It's hard for me to memorize them without context. And unfortunately, I don't have Windows 7 to play with some of these on, like I've been looking at in my notes today.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It makes it tough to actually...
There is a trial version of Windows 7, and yes, it installs into VMware Fusion without a problem, and yes, you get 120 days to play with it. So, meh.
Ooh, I don't know if my Mac can basically do that, but I should try it.
Yeah, you can do it by rote, and you can memorize it, or you can find yourself a Windows 7 machine to play with. They made sure in the curriculum that you have all the resources. Yeah, they make sure you have all the resources in case you don't have Windows 7. It just makes it harder, and you have to do it basically by memory. We talk about collector sets. We'll play with these in Module 12 as well. It's going to watch multiple streams of data and basically do the same thing as your alerts did that we were just talking about. And this is a Windows 7 thing. We've got Event Viewer. This logs a history of events regarding applications, security, and the system. These log files are a valuable troubleshooting tool. Path for that, which we don't need. And there's paths for Windows Vista and Windows 7, which we also...
The other thing, the reason they put the paths in, guys, is because in all of the Microsoft knowledge base documentation, that's how it's written.
Yeah.
Start, settings, control panel. So, yes, they're hard to memorize. You're not meant to memorize them. You're meant to follow along in the book and know it is time to turn the page when it says turn the page. Nobody's going to give you a cookie for remembering the path to... You just got to recognize them when you see them.
There's something about the event...
Help does the same thing.
You're really quiet, Sean.
Whoa, how did my mic get all the way up there? To be Hello. Fair, the Mac does the same thing, where it does Apple greater than... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they do. Slash, yeah. We did hear you, but you were just very quiet. Yeah, it does all the... A lot of help files do that. You'll see it even in the Braille Sense one.
It's the easiest way to verbalize a set of steps that are in a GUI, because there's no other real easy way, because everything sort of floats and shifts. You can't... You know, it's not like DOS where it says type the following 6 commands. You basically just have objects to tag off as you describe what you're doing.
Something to know about the event viewer. You're going to see lots of events there. That does not mean you have lots of errors. You'll get to play with the event view in 5.5.1 to see events. So not every event is a scary, horrible error. There are a lot of them that just say, okay, you've opened this program. Okay, you've started this service. And that's okay. Not everything in Event Viewer is a horrible catastrophe, so don't be scared of your Event Viewer. There's a scam going around. Well, they'll have you look in your Event Viewer. Do you see all those events? There's so much wrong with your computer. Well, no. No, that's basically stuff starting and stopping. It's not that big a deal. Alright. We'll quickly talk about the MMC, which you'll get to play with in a lab. This allows you to organize management tools called snap-ins in one location for easy administration. You can use web page links, tasks, ActiveX controls, and folders. They'll all be able to be added into the MMC. After you've configured it, you'll need to save it to keep all the tools and links in that MMC. And you can create as many of these as needed, each with a different name and set of stuff. This is useful for multiple administrators managing different aspects of the same computer. Each administrator can have individualized MMCs for monitoring and configuring computer settings. And of course, you'll be needing administrator privileges to do this. And we've got our paths, of course, which you guys will want to look at. You can also do this on remote computers, and they've got paths for that. We've got performance settings. To enhance the performance of your OS, you can change some of the settings that your computer uses, such as virtual memory configuration settings. And you'll get to do that in Module 12 as well. To change virtual memory settings in Windows XP, you're going to go
Please
Start, Control Panel, Systems, Advanced Performance Area, Settings. It's okay.
That's okay.
Good night. That's okay. So we can change those, and most of the time, actually, Windows does a fairly good job of taking care of these settings anyway. The only thing you really might want to change is your virtual memory location. Questions on the administrative tools?
Woohoo!
Okay.
Sorry.
What?
I've just finished looking at the exam. I got it to finally
that's
get.
All we have time for today. We'll actually finish. We really will finish this module next week. We probably have seriously like 15 minutes left of it basically talking about how to navigate the GUI, which is pretty easy stuff. We'll quiz, we'll do Module 6, or most.
Yay, and all my notes are pretty much done. So.
Yay! If you guys haven't finished your labs, really, guys, now's the time to do it. For everybody else, you can have a restful week. You can take the Module 5 exam if you want to. Otherwise, sit back, relax, have a nice, relaxing week without worrying about labs. For the rest of you, it's time to do your labs and get more labs done. And for me, it's time to grade a bunch of labs now that my other class has finally finished.
The other thing is, keep in mind, guys, we do not stop for Easter. So just be warned, we just go straight through.
That's good to know.
Since our lectures fall on a Wednesday night, we don't stop that week.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because we need all the time we can get.
Oh yeah, you've got a lot to put in a very short amount of time. It's very understandable. Yeah. Keep taking breaks here and there, you'll run out of time quickly.
Yep, we will. So we don't. And we have a lot of good discussions, so we, you know, we basically run
the thing is,
everything.
If we really have to, and I don't know if I should mention this now, but if we really, really, really have to, and we get really far behind, we can go to two lectures for an hour and a half each. We've done that before, if we really
Yeah, we'll do
so
a split.
Panic. It actually wasn't too bad.